Hello and welcome to the Pratfalls podcast. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. You can find me on Twitter at ThatLevi. You can find the show, Pratfalls Pod, on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook. This episode is my conversation with Corey LaQuest's poem. Corey is a lot of things, an actor, improviser, playwright, producer, activist. I really enjoyed connecting with Corey. I want to mention a couple of items. One, I had a setting slightly wrong on the microphone recording this. I haven't made a mistake like that in a while. So there are times when the audio is a little pitched up, and I apologize for that. I think it's still very listenable, and I really want to share this conversation, but I am aware there's a little bit of distortion at times, and I apologize. Also, if you have not checked it out yet, please look at my other podcast project that I've recently launched called Not About You, Conversations About Identity and Social Justice. You can go to naypod.com, N-A-Y-P-O-D.com, or just look up Not About You on whatever podcast app you use. Don't forget, you can always rate and review Pratfalls Podcast on iTunes. It lets people know about it. All right, enough self-plugging. Here is my conversation with Corey. So I'm talking to Corey LaQuest Pullum. Corey, thanks for giving me your time and agreeing to just talk and tell me about yourself.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to do a thing where I attempt to describe your work, your creative work, and then you can tell me what I missed or how I've misrepresented you. So my perception of your, at least public creative work, is that you are an actor, mm-hmm. an improviser, mm-hmm. a producer, a writer. I want to say educator, but I don't know how much you identify as that.
I'm a teaching artist.
Yeah.
I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah, that counts. Within those buckets, I'm sure there's lots of subsects. And so I'm curious both if those things are all true and what you would add to that multi-hyphenated list of creative selves.
I mean, that kind of hits on just about everything. I suppose collaborator is something that I really take seriously with everything that I do. I like to collaborate a whole lot and bring together different people who wouldn't normally be in the same room to make things happen. An activist. I would say activist is also something that I take pride in doing as well.
Yeah. I'll go back eventually, but I am curious about that because that activist label means so many things. Mm-hmm. And it seems like some of that I see embedded in your work. And so I'm curious both if, do you see any of your creative work, does it all have some level of activism in it? Or are you selecting certain projects that are built around?
I would say that not every single thing I do has an activist intention behind it. Sometimes I just like to do art for art's sake. And it's not often, but sometimes my brain and I just need that, you know, that release. But I would say the majority of things that I do, there's definitely an activist kind of theme going on there, or intention for sure. For example, I think that Blackout is something that could be looked at as activism.
And that's is it all black folks who are
on stage? I mean, we also have a Native American member as well. His name's Cole Miner. He hasn't had a chance to do a show with us just yet because he's just a busy dude. But pretty much all POC, people of color, on stage. And we have some writers as well who are people of color. And we have a couple of white writers as well. But what you see on stage is going to be people of color, for sure.
And that was my understanding of that is it's you guys wanting, it's you finding some folks you want to work with, but also a reaction to seeing sort of an absence. Is that part of what Blackout is built on?
It's definitely kind of both. It's the main reason why it was created in the first place is because we saw a lack of people of color on stage, not just in the improv community, but in the comedy community in general. And so we're trying to empower people of color and give them space and give them a seat at the table by putting our bodies on stage, which kind of naturally brings more people of color into the audiences. And I think that since we've started, I've seen more and more people of color on stages in the comedy community, not nearly as much as there should be, but we're definitely seeing at least a small growth, which is great. Yeah, so I think that it was definitely originally started and created because we saw just such a lack of ourselves and people who look like us and sound like us on stages.
So I'm curious if the just because we're talking about Blackout, if there's a weird tension that it's doing the work of addressing a representation problem. Both you guys are created a space where you can, especially in improvisation, there's this sort of safe space, and yet a lot of strange infractions or microaggressions happen even within improv collective due to lack of awareness or just strange moments that happen. And I think a lot of that can happen around race when it's mostly white spaces, and then there's like that one person of color in a group. So some of it is just addressing that. But because you have created this, it's all people of color performing company, then that becomes, that's the thing. So now it's, oh, you want people of color, go see this one group of that. And so I think you always have to have those moments of even overtly being othered. But then success will be where Blackout isn't a big deal anymore. So is there any tension where you guys are getting a lot of attention right now? And a lot of it's because you're just actually doing good work. I mean, you put together, you guys are a really good group of veteran performers and writers. But also it's, oh, this is a novelty. This is interesting. So like media wants to write about it. People want to support it, and people want to feel good. Like we're really good allies. And that's great. And you can capitalize on that. But then you kind of want that to quiet down, but you kind of like the attention because it's great for marketing. And
Well, I think that definitely the goal is to, like you said, the goal is to, eventually we won't be a novelty. That will not be the main reason why. And I'm glad you said, you know, I don't think that the only reason why we are where we are is because we're the only thing like us right now.
Oh, you're really funny.
I would hope that people aren't just supporting us because of the novelty aspect of what we're doing. And I think that a lot of people would vouch for the fact that that isn't. But the goal is to where there are not just, there's not just one Blackout, but there's like a whole slew of groups like Blackout. You know, the goal is, so by putting ourselves on stage and kind of taking the baton going forward, that other people of color will also say, oh, okay, I can do that. Like, that's something that seems doable. Like, it doesn't seem like it's an impossible thing. This is something I can do. And of course, like, we want it to grow. Like, we don't like being the only one of the only groups that are like us around. Like, that's not something that we want. Has there been some kind of I would say that's definitely helped us, that novelty feeling. I think that's something that's definitely, in terms of publicity and all that, like, people are interested because they've just never seen anything like it before. And there's something about being the first, you know, to do something like this that makes people say, oh my gosh, I want to support them and throw my allyship at them. But what I would hope is that as more and more groups come to the forefront like us, that people won't stop supporting us. They won't stop supporting other groups like us, that they'll keep supporting all the POC groups that are out there, not only because of what the novelty aspect, but because of just the quality of the performance. And I think that's something that Blackout has always kind of tried to exemplify, that yes, we do have this kind of novelty to us, but we don't want to just lean on that. We don't want to just solely rely on that. We have to present good improv forward because we have that responsibility. We take that, we don't take it lightly. We take it very seriously that we bring good work forward. And so I think that's definitely a combination of both. The fact that we are not just one of the only groups like us out there, but that we are also a good group of improvisers.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing that can happen where you could become a lot of people's first exposure to live improvisation. And so then suddenly it's on you for them whether they like improv or not. Or the really unfair thing of, I don't like improv by people of color. So you are doing a thing to push for progress that can be sort of immediately misrepresented and mistaken too, which is a strange challenge.
We've had, I can't even count how many people have told us, like, this is the first time I've seen improv, it's not like I thought it was, or I have seen improv, this is the first time I liked it. Because what we do is different. It is different. Like, we don't, it's not just, you know, go out, take suggestion, and get started. You know, there are, I'd say that our style and the way that we go about improv is pretty different. And also, like, we do more than just improv. Like, the kind of the different sections of performance that we do before we even jump into the improv, the the take them to church section and the, you know, make it plain section and these different things that we do that are kind of SNL based or what have you that we do before the improv even gets started. I think it's a good way to kind of just show people, first of all, like, here's what we offer to the table before we even get into the improvisation, just as performers and what our strong suits are. And then we'll get into the improvisation where we have real conversations and break it down. And I think that people appreciate that. And so if you're new to improv or if you've never seen it, you're getting a look at, you know, many different types of improvisation and of, you know, performance in front of you, comedy performance in front of you before you even get to that. I think there's just such a stigma behind improv.
Yeah.
There's a very strong, like, negative stigma against improv and people to avoid it like the plague because you just don't know what you're getting yourself into, especially you have to pay money to get in. It's like, what am I getting into?
Because it's process and product at the same time.
Yeah. And so I take pride in the fact that a lot of people's first, like, introduction to improv, and that people a lot of times will say, you know, I want to come back, I want to check out more, because we've given them a good first taste to what it is and what it can be.
And then people can go be disappointed after your show.
Yeah, exactly.
Other shows.
Where we have no responsibility, but we've done our part.
Well, I'm curious, because for me, I found improv when I was like 18. Like, mm-hmm. I was a funny dude in the locker room,
sure,
who didn't know that wasn't just annoying and that it was a skill set.
Yeah.
And I felt like I found a place I could, my brain was made sense. And since then, I've built a sort of creative self and all that identity, but it was definitely my first home, because it just fit how I'm more comfortable with no plan in life in general as well. So I'm curious for you, because you do a lot, you do a pretty significant mixture of heavily scripted, heavily rehearsed material. Mm-hmm. You know, you are in full-length plays with organizations like the Guthrie Theater and a lot of places in Chicago, and that is... There's the same kind of collaborative elements to working with other people, but the creation style is very different from improv.
Definitely.
So I wonder which you came to first, and if you're surprised by how you're able to operate in both of those spaces.
I would say that there is the same amount. There's definitely a fair amount of collaboration in both, in unscripted and scripted, but it's just so completely different in how it happens. With non-scripted, like with improvisation, you're really relying on each other to create the story and to see where it's going and things like that. Whereas with scripted theater, like, you know, when I do a show at the Guthrie or I do a show at the Children's Theater Company or wherever it may be, the script is already there. There's already a director who you know is going to guide you. There's already, you know, designers who are going to say, okay, the lights look like this and the set's going to look like this and blah, blah, blah. So you become such a smaller part of the you're such a small cog in the large machine that this theater project is. You know, I just did Parchment Hour at the Guthrie a month or so ago, and you know, you're such a small part of it. Now when you're in the run and you're in performance, like, okay, then you can take much more control of this is now our baby and our thing. But it's definitely collaborative that there's so many people who come together to make this thing happen. And I think that's one of my favorite things about theater, the art form of theater in general, scripted theater especially, is that it takes so many people to make it happen. You know, so many people who have a vision as to what this world is and what the play is and what it's about and things like that. And, you know, how do we want to tackle it? And it's crazy how so many different people can have such different visions, but it all kind of works together to push the same cohesive story forward. And so I'd say that there's definitely collaboration in both, just in such completely different ways. But yeah, I love both. I love to do both. I haven't been doing improv very long. I've only been doing improv for about 2-3 years tops, and I'm always amazed by how collaborative that feels, and how if you're trying to, you know, if you've got 5 people in a group, like say Blackout when we started, you know, if 2 of us are trying to drive it, but 3 of us are hanging back, we're so much weaker that way. It takes all of us kind of adding in and chipping away at this thing altogether. Whereas, you know, you see some groups where it's like one person kind of driving the car. It's like, okay, we'll just kind of watch and we'll go whatever you say. It's just no fun that way. I think that everything is better, made better when you can collaborate, you know, and try to tackle one goal together.
So when you were young, not that you're not young now, but like a child, were you already into theater, or what was your, what did you think of as creative work you were doing when you were like, you know, I know a bunch of people who are like, I was in fourth grade and I was in the You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And that's like they knew they wanted to be an actor. So I wonder, when you were a kid, did you have a, were you already making theater kind of things? Were you doing other stuff that was creative?
I was not exposed to theater for until the ninth grade in high school. But I always knew I wanted to perform. One of my very earliest memories as a child was watching Thriller for the first time, the music video by Michael Jackson, and with Michael Jackson. And I just was so blown away by this like magical being and what they were doing. And I just remember being like, I want to do that so badly. I want to just perform. I want to be able to like capture people in that way. And I started off in church actually singing a lot. Music has always kind of been my like kind of my first passion, my go to from an early age. And so I always knew I wanted to entertain, but theater didn't even enter my mind as a possibility until about the ninth grade, 10th grade, when I saw my very first show. The very first theater show I ever saw was Rent in New York.
Oh, wow. And, like on Broadway?
On Broadway.
Nice.
And I remember thinking, like, this is amazing. But also, I'm from South Texas, so I was like, whoa, there's a lot happening. Lots of drugs, lots of homosexuality, lots of nudity, lots of cursing, lots of everything. And I was just like, my mind was blown. Like, there's just so much. It was to take in the social things happening within the play, as well as just the play itself. I was just kind of like, my mind worked at what was happening in front of me. I remember being at intermission, my friends being like, this is stupid, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, this is amazing. And so that's when the theater bug kind of bit me. And that was a summer after I'd done my first play, actually. I kind of stumbled on it on accident. I was a sports guy. I've been doing sports my whole life, football, basketball, and track my whole life. Since I was like 6, 7 years old, doing all those things. And one day, track practice was canceled, and I just happened to stumble upon a theater audition happening for a play that my school was doing. And I auditioned, and I actually didn't get in. But the role that I was mainly auditioning for, that lead actor who was a senior, he had gotten into it with the director. And so she's like 2 or 3 weeks before the show goes up is like, you know, can you still do it? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I got to talk to my coach, but all right, I'll see. And my coach hated it, but I did it anyway. And that's kind of how I got my start, was in ninth grade. So I definitely didn't come up in it. I was not exposed to it much. There's just not much theater in Corpus Christi at all. We had one community theater called the Harbor Playhouse, and now we have one other theater called Aurora Arts or something like that. And so Corpus Christi just doesn't have much theater arts, and so that's definitely not something that I just was exposed to at early.
Well, so
age.
If it wasn't super common in your community growing up, what was it like? Like, did you have to do a coming out to family that this is going to be my profession? You know, what, there's a lot of ideas around you can't make a living as an artist.
Definitely.
Although I think we've all now come to the conclusion that you maybe can't make a living doing anything. So you might as well. You know, at least artists know how to have a bunch of stuff going on because the stability doesn't seem to be there anymore.
For sure.
Which I take as an advantage to creative folks.
Yeah.
But was there tension about, what are you doing? You know, like, you have so many abilities and this is where you're going to put them? You know?
Yeah. I would definitely say that the closer I got to going to college is when that was starting to happen. I think that throughout high school, my parents were just happy that I was not in trouble or that I was just having some kind of positive outlet to do something. And I was the further I went through high school, the more attention I started putting on theater, going to different competitions throughout the state and traveling with my theater teacher to do things like competitions at, you know, in different cities.
Were you doing like monologue performances?
Like, monologue performances, like things like humorous interpretation and dramatic interpretation and duet acting and blah, 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 things like that. Like competitive, let's make the arts a sport, you know, things like that. And so I started to do that, and I was just putting a lot of attention into that, and it was a positive outlet for me. And I think that the closer I got to college and was like, I want to do this in college too, is when my parents started being like, well, let's consider all your options. And so they're really trying to push me being a teacher, you know, just make sure you also get like a teaching certificate, blah, blah, blah. And I always felt like that was just such a, I feel like if you have, it's very not smart, and I wouldn't say this to most people, but by having a plan B, it weakens your plan A, I feel like, because you know that plan B is there. It's like, well, I always know that if I can't make it, then I'll have this teaching certificate. I feel like by not getting the teaching certificate, I kind of put myself in this mindset of like, well, I have no choice but to like...
If you have no fallback, you can't fall.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so... They did not like it, and for the longest time they thought I was getting a teaching certificate. They thought I was in school and that was something that was still happening. And I remember there being a moment where they kind of realized like, he's not getting a teaching certificate. Mm-hmm. He's just kind of all in on this acting thing, and that caused some tension for sure, especially with my mom, who just assumed that I was doing that as well. And it's like, I'm just trying to go for it. And so there was a little bit of tension, but I think at the end of the day, they're always supportive of what I wanted to do, and they trusted me to just try to make it happen. And they also, I think they knew that they couldn't stop me. Like, they knew that I was very passionate about it, and that I was going to do what I wanted to do regardless of what they wanted me to do at the end of the day. So, yeah, there was definitely tension, but at the end of the day, I was going to do what I wanted to do anyway.
Well, you seem like you have a lot of drive, whether that is called ambition or what that is. And so I wonder, do you have motivation techniques? Like, how many decisions are you making around, I just need to pay bills?
Mm.
Or are you able to fold in, I can kind of take care of that, but I can still make most of my decisions about what's going to be creatively fulfilling and sort of have other motivations beyond the money stuff? Because I know the money stuff is sort of an endless trick.
Yeah, the money stuff is tough because you just, especially as a freelance artist, you just don't know where it's going to come from on any given day most times. And you just kind of have to walk out on faith that somehow your bills are going to get paid.
Yeah.
And so that's a scary part of it. And sometimes it's like, oh, I'm behind on these bills. I need to figure out how to make something happen. But honestly, I don't make a ton of decisions based on I need to get these bills paid. A lot of times it's just like, what artistically is going to feed, like what is artistically intriguing me or feeding me my artistic hunger at any given moment. Now, I will say that I have put in place certain things that happen at certain times, like consistently, that I know, okay, I'll at least make some money off of that or off that or off that at this point. So I have put strategically in place, like there will for certain be a blackout show at least once a month, every month. There's some income there. I for sure will be teaching every Monday as a teaching artist, you know, through in the fall at this point, I for sure. So I think that artistically, I try to do both. I try to kind of do the two birds, one stone thing where it's like, you know, I want to set myself up to be artistically fed, but also set myself up that I know that financially I'll be okay because I've got this and this and this happening at these times and I know I don't have to stress out. And so it's definitely a matter of just kind of taking what comes. And when after the things that are kind of thrown at me and died down, it's like, okay, now what can I create out of thin air to also supplement paying my bills as well? You know, if I know I'm going to be doing a show at the Guthrie in the fall, it's like, okay, that financially will help a lot because it's just one of the best paying gigs in town. So where I can kind of be a little easier on myself in terms of the different jobs I have to take up. But say, like, next summer I'm doing a gig with Girl Friday Productions called Idiot's Delight, and that doesn't pay as much as the Guthrie at all. So I know that in the summertime, I need to be thinking about what do I want to artistically do that will not only feed me as an artist, but feed me. You know, so it's just planning and plotting. Like, I feel like you just got to be smart in that way. Kind of, you have to be thinking way ahead a lot of times. Like, you know, it's just a lot of thinking ahead. So for me in the summertime, it's like, okay, what improv things can I be thinking about trying to create, or what am I doing, like a fringe show that will hopefully make some money, or will I be doing, you know, whatever, X, Y, and Z. It's just basically trying to just balance. It's a big game of balancing. It's a balancing act for sure.
In sort of that same vein, do you have like a forward looking goal or objective? Like, are you trying to get to a place, or you've achieved just? I mean, there's the profile-y theater companies in the Twin Cities, and you've worked with a lot of them in multiple spaces, the comedy spaces and in the sort of dramatic spaces. And that takes a certain, I think, goal setting. As much as people feel like, oh, wow, you got lucky. And there's that too, but you have to be prepared for when the lucky happens. But do you feel like you are trying to build towards something, or are you just trying to live within what you're doing?
Honestly, I just want to be, I've always just wanted to be a tool in the community. That probably sounds so pretentious to say, but like, I feel like a lot of what I do is always saying, okay, what's missing? What is missing? What can I do to supply for what is missing? Lack of, you know, POC representation on stage, create blackout. Lack of stories that I want to see in scripted theater, create underdog theater. You know, I feel like I'm just constantly trying to plug the holes of what is missing, try to give all of myself in that way. I will say, when I first moved here, the goal was, okay, there are some theaters I really would like to work for, and not even just for like the glamorous, oh, I get to work at these places, but just because like
you do have to say it that way, though. There's some kind of rule that you have to have a pretentious voice.
Yeah, of course. Oh, the Guthrie, you know, there are just certain places that I look up to their artistic caliber. Like, when I think about Mixed Blood Theater, I think about, oh my gosh, that is such a pillar of artistic excellence. When I think about Pillsbury House Theater, where I had the good fortune to work, Penumbra Theater, I was like, I mean, that's a whole nother level of, like, you know, August Wilson, one of the greatest playwrights of all time, who happens to be a black man. Was a black man, rest in peace, star August Wilson. He, you know, his artistic home was Penumbra Theater, and I have the great privilege to do a new work there in the spring. And so I think that when I first moved here, there are definitely places that I was like, I want to work at these places. Like, that would be so cool to do. But I don't think it was a matter of wanting to just like check boxes. It was just because, as an artist, like, you know, if you're a basketball player and you're coming up and you're playing at the time of Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, you're like, I want to be on the same court as them. I'm going to face off against those people. Like, you know, if, you know, with anything like that, if you're a comedian and if you can get on SNL, or if you can get, I mean, I don't know anymore, but if you can get on whatever it may be, like, whatever that top thing is for you, like, you know, you want to be able to do those things. And so, honestly, I think that I'm not in that place anymore, because I feel like, and I don't know how it sounds, but I've kind of, if there was any boxes to be checked, I feel like I've kind of done that. I've worked at places that I feel very proud to have worked and held a significant space in some of those places. But it was never about checking boxes. It's always just been about artistically doing the things that intrigue me and be in places that I feel like do excellent work. Because there are some large institutions in the city that I just don't have any desire to work for, honestly. Like,
let's name them.
I won't do it, because I don't want this podcast to get shut down.
I'm not afraid. I don't,
But there are just certain places that, like, that are huge institutions, you know, I won't name them, but they're the largest institution that has the most theater seats in town. I just have no intention to work there, because they don't do the kind of work that I care to do. I just have no intentions of any kind. And places that pay well and have runs that go for months and months and months in the burbs, that I also don't care to work there. Mm-hmm. It's just certain places I just don't care to be there. But, you know, up until recently, the Guthrie. Like, I mean, it's the Guthrie, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, of course, like, the actor in me, the artist in me was like, oh man, it's the Guthrie, but they've done so much work in the past, I was like, I don't care to be in any of those shows. But recently, with new leadership, there's a lot of things happening there that I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like kind of the building to be in now.
And you could take on the responsibility of sort of holding accountability to some pivoting on mission.
Mm-hmm.
Like you, I think part of you saying yes to being in some of those spaces is, all right, you've said some really good things and you're putting together some programming that's maybe more compelling.
Mm.
I'm going to be here, and hopefully that also pushes you to...
Yeah, well, I think that by being in those spaces where you're not, where people of color or women or whoever are usually in, by you being there, you take on a responsibility in some way to kind of vouch for and speak for and act on behalf of so many people who don't have that opportunity. So when I'm in the room for Parchment Hour, when I'm in the room for Choir Boy, when I'm in the room for whatever show I'm doing at the Guthrie or any place that, that is slowly kind of coming to the tide of change, you kind of take on that responsibility of like, okay, I need to be the mouthpiece for people who don't get to be here or what have you. You take on that responsibility. So yeah, I've been very fortunate to work for places that I definitely look up to and places that I've always admired. And I, at the end of the day, I just want to create art that is changing people, that is making people think. I think at the end of the day, that's all I've ever really strived to do, because I mean, you know, I get the same thrill from a, you know, 700 plus audience at the Guthrie that I do with a 100 seat theater, you know, for Blackout, you know, if not more so with Blackout, because I know that we have full control of what we're doing, what we're saying. And we can be so unapologetic and uncensored in what we do as well. And I feel like it's just so raw, you know. And I would challenge people to think that, you know, it doesn't matter the amount of seats or the amount of people who are there, but what are you doing? What's the substance of mm-hmm. the art that you're creating?
Yeah, you can be soulless in a huge space.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
I mean, that it's definitely. Not that hard.
It's not.
So one thing I just want to, that jumped out at me is when you're talking about, if you're a professional athlete, you want to be on the court with the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a professional actor, same holds true. But the idea that, so you can see, like, I want to play with Michael Jordan, I want to play mm-hmm. with LeBron.
Yeah.
It is true. If you want to be professional, you want mm-hmm. to work with a certain level of person to push you to be better.
Mm-hmm.
But that also requires a certain confidence, because definitely. I can think of plenty of people who are like, you know
yeah.
what? I don't really need to get embarrassed by mm-hmm. being on the court yeah. with LeBron right now.
Yeah.
And I think you can feel that way as a performer, too. You're
definitely.
Like, look, I'm good. I'm still figuring it out. I don't think anyone's ever done figuring it out. So are you aware of your confidence? Do you feel like that comes from something? Do you have to know when to apply it and when to pretend you're not? Like,
mm-hmm.
is it as real as it just sounded? Like,
mm-hmm.
where are you sitting? Where do you sit with confidence?
Honestly, it reminds me of, like, Mufasa. I always quote Mufasa in Lion King. He's like, I'm only brave when I have to be,
yeah.
you know? And that's how I feel a lot of the times. So, like, I feel like I'm absolutely confident when I have to be. I'm brave when I have to be. Like, I always know who I am and what I bring to the table. Like, that's a constant. Like, I never go into a space not knowing who I am, what I bring to the table, the perspective that I have. I am very confident in that way. Like, I know that I hold a certain power as a human, and I think in Minnesota especially, it's like, oh no, I'm just little old me, you yeah. know. But
that's very aggressive feeling in yeah, the Midwest,
you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It is, like,
which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's very, you have to be very apologetic about the power that you hold. But I always tell people, like, own who you are. Like, you have to own who you are and what you bring to the table. And I feel like I've always done that because my parents just raised me that way. My I just come from that kind of family. Like, we're very proud people, we're very confident people. So I feel like I'm very confident, but there are times where I don't really feel that way, but I force myself to be. Like, one of the most intimidating things in the world was when I was doing a show at the Brave New Workshop called The Working Dead, and every night after a performance, I believe we would do a set, like an improv set. And I mean, those are some of the best improv comedic minds in town, you know, Lauren Anderson and Taj Ruler and all these different people. And so, like, there's times where she steps out and I'm like, oh my gosh, am I going to be in the scene with Lauren Anderson? I'm like, no, yes, I am going to be in the scene with Lauren Anderson. And I'm going to try to, like, just be there toe-to-toe with her, because, like, while she is she's just such a force in terms of her comedic abilities and her improv mind. She's, like, one of the best I've ever seen. But I can't be afraid to go out there and do what I do, I'm not going to get any better. I'm not going to, you know, I can't back down from that.
Yeah.
And so there are just certain people that I look forward to being in that same space as them. Kind of like that, you know, if you, you know, like we were saying, if LeBron James is out there, you want to be on the court with LeBron James. I want to be out there with Lauren Anderson. I want to be out there with, you know, Sally Wingard in the scripted theater world. I want to be out there with the best because I feel like that will only help make me better and help me grow. And that's not to say that there's nothing to learn from people, that your confidence doesn't mean that you don't have anything to learn or that you're the best or whatever, but it's just confident in knowing that you are the only person who is like you. I'm the only Corey Lucas Pullum in the world, and that will ever be. And there's a certain pride and confidence that comes with that knowledge. And so I think that the more that we own that we are a singular being, that no one is like us, the more confident that you can be. Yeah, I love sharing a stage with people that intimidate me a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you've articulated, I think one thing is super true of sort of truly great at it people is, I mean, particularly maybe to improv in my experience, but even theater in general, they actually do elevate the people they're with rather than the risk of them looking so good compared to you. Someone like Lauren is going to make every decision you make in an improv scene seem genius, even though you're hacking away at nonsense. And I think that's true with a script like somebody like Sally Wingert, too. You might stumble through a moment that you've been doing well and you're having an off night, and she can just slightly pivot so that it totally justifies that energy change. And I don't know what that's like in sports. You know, I didn't go anywhere beyond high school, so I don't know if that feels collaborative or what that feels like. But I think you're getting at something where that can inform your work. And then I also just really like the idea of stop apologizing for confidence.
Yeah, I say that in classes. I say that in just about, I just find myself having to say that so often, more so here than anywhere I've ever been, you know. More than I lived in Chicago, I lived in Texas, I've been in New York a little bit, but here I have had to say that so many times to people, like, own it, own what you are, who you are, what you do, what you bring to the table. Like, you, there's only one you. Like, that's, I just truly, that always comes to mind. Like, that for me is like one of the biggest lessons I ever learned in school, is like, you are the only person like you, there will never be anyone like you ever again. So you have to own that.
And then when you say that, I'm sure someone says, oh, you're right, I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, I remember a audition class I took, I don't know, like 15 years ago, and the instructor said, don't go to an audition and try to be what you think they want, because if you're trying to be like a certain different person, you're not as good as that person, but you can be the best you. And that seems so obvious, but I think there's like a daily practice of keeping that in your mind.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah, because the more you try to be like others, you're just dooming yourself to fail. I feel like a lot of times we especially within audition situations or whatever, we're like, okay, I know that this person works here a lot, or I know that this person has this gig already. What do they do? What do they do right? Like, whatever. And the same thing goes with like measuring sticks, right? We look at someone else's career and we say, okay, what am I doing that person's not, or what am I not doing that person is doing or whatever. And I just feel like we're all such different people. Like, we can't measure ourselves in that way. We can't compare ourselves in that way. You're dooming yourself to fail. Like, don't try to, and Facebook, with like Facebook and things, it's so hard. Like, it's so hard to not look at other people's careers or what their lives and be like, oh, they're in such a higher place or whatever. Like, what am I doing wrong? Nah, man, it just keep doing what you're doing and just find out how you can keep making yourself better. Like, don't just coast. Like, what can you do to continue to make your craft or yourself as a person, you know, better and improve?
But if I don't compare myself to someone else, how can I win? I'm curious about what your schedule looks like. Because I know from my past as living as a freelance person, as a freelance artist, it was changed all the time, and I know my life now that I'm always overscheduled, and some of that's the only way I get anything done is by having too much to do, so that I can be procrastinating, and it just means I'm doing something else. But you are doing things, you got to do a few things that you care about, but that also make you money. You're doing some big projects that'll take up a ton of your time, and suddenly you are working 16-hour days, and you have to like disappear from your social circles. those can be really challenging things to navigate. Does that mean you, all your friends are just artists? Like, is that who you mostly are relating to? Because they get that. Like, what do you, what does your social life look like? And what do you, how do you track where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be there?
I would say that, weirdly enough, I have almost more friends who are not artists, actually, than are artists, which is crazy to think of, but it's
artists
true.
Are annoying, so it's...
Well, also, artists are busy. Like, yeah. Other artists are busy. So, like, when I'm not busy, most of my artist friends are. Mm. And it also is because I'm not from here, so a lot of the friends I made when I first got here were people I just kind of would just meet at random places, like when I would just stumble into a bar or... You know, I got here, I moved here in the summer of 2013, so I would just go, like, down to Calhoun, the Calhoun Lake, or Harriet Lake, or whatever, and just kind of just hang out down there and just meet random people. So a lot of those random people that I met in those first, like, months that I first got here are some of my best friends now in this town. Now, that's not to say that a lot of my best friends aren't artists, because they are. In terms of just, like, who I hang out with and things like that, a lot of them are not artists, actually. And I actually like that healthy disconnect sometimes, because it's so easy to get so wrapped up in art and artists.
And it feels like the biggest thing in the world,
you know,
always.
Yeah, yeah. Like, sometimes you need that disconnect. And but, I mean, I love my artist friends. And in terms of my schedule, it just depends on what I'm doing at the time. You know, there are times where... You know, life is a lot slower. Like, right now, life is not nearly as busy as it was when I was in the midst of, like, I would say, like, just thinking in the recent memory, one of my craziest times this year was when I was doing Parchment Hour while also producing and rehearsing for Baltimore is Burning, because the Guthrie performance schedule is just so tedious. Like, you're doing a show every single day except Monday. And especially on the weekends, it was rough because I was writing, in the midst of writing and developing this play that I'm also producing, that I'm also the artistic director for. So there's so many hats that I'm wearing and trying to make sure, like, you know, what lighting instruments are going to have for the show, what props and how are they going to get there, what costumes do we have, like, what's the publicity like, blah, blah, blah. It's like the different things that we have to think about when it's just like me, it's me and my friend Lamar Jefferson, who's also the associate artist director of Underdog Theater. When Parchment Hour was going on, while Baltimore is Burning was going on at the same time, and also teaching and also just doing blackout shows, and there's a lot of juggling. There's a lot of just trying to manage time. And you know, I've told myself I can't keep overbooking myself this way going into the new year, but it's probably just going to keep happening, if not worse.
Well, maybe you'll stop getting opportunities. I mean, you can always hope.
That's the thing, though, is that, like, it's not even a matter of the opportunities. It's a matter of being able to say no.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not good at saying
no.
It is. It's really hard.
Because
you scrape
for so long, too.
Yeah. Well, the thing is like, because I remember the times where I was begging for jobs, or I was begging for opportunities, like, please hire me, please give me a chance. And now that things have turned around, you know, thankfully, I'm very fortunate. Things have definitely turned around that I don't find myself having to beg, whereas now I'm doing more turning away than asking. Just time management and knowing when okay, I can say no to this thing. There are certain things that's like, and even if I want to do this thing, maybe, like, now is not the time. Somewhere down the line, maybe I'll revisit that and we can try that at that point. But, like, just gotta manage, it's time management. So, like, for example, like, right now, life has slowed down significantly. Like, Baltimore is Burning is over. I don't have any, like, scripted theater gigs going on right now. Really, all I have going on is Blackout and this teaching gig that I do every now and then. And that's really it. And so, financially, right now, what's good is that, like, I can take money that I saved, say, like, when I was doing that Guthrie gig or whatever, like, the stuff that pays more, save that and apply it to my rent now, my bills now, and to where I can be able to just relax a bit more. Because I feel like when you're going like that, all you want to do is just sleep. there's no time for sleep. So now is my time to be able... Time I can just take to just breathe a little bit more. And I'm also going to be going out of town soon. I'm just kind of just letting my mind just kind of re-up and just, re-energize before I go into this new year, because the new year is going to be very slammed with a lot of things kind of back to back to back. I have a lot of gigs that are kind of go right into each other, and I start rehearsing for a 10,000 Things Theater show January 2nd. You know, pretty much like the new year and time to work again. So I'm just taking December mostly to just like kind of relax and just be able to digest and kind of reflect on what this year has been like. Because it's been a crazy year in terms of my professional career. It's just it's been one of my best years, if not my best year, definitely. Like right now it's slow, but there are definitely times where it's super, super busy.
Yeah, well, and kicking into 10,000 Things is a pretty involved rehearsal and performance process.
Definitely.
So that'll pull energy that you need to bank right now.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just the way you talk about it, and what I actually see you doing this, it sounds like one of your goals, thinking of yourself as an artist and an activist, means you are both representing ideas, taking up and holding space, but then creating space for others. Those often can work together, but it can seem in contrast at times. There's a real challenge, I think, for someone who has some success and is representing multiple communities and representing big ideas and getting attention for it, but who also wants to be about creating opportunities for other folks who haven't been represented. And that's such a big part of your work. I wonder how you hold that in your mind, the desire to, you want to go perform and work in these spaces, you want to make these kinds of shows, you want to do this kind of improv show, you want to work on this kind of, you're writing plays and putting those up. And all of those can involve you bringing in other folks, but there can be a challenge of, is this my thing to do right now, or am I in the way of someone else doing it? Is that anything that you are dealing with, thinking about, negotiating?
I think that I'm always trying to keep in mind, how can we be socially effective? Like 75 to 80% of the time, at the very least, I'm always thinking with my civic mind and trying to create work and create space for people who are also trying to tackle that same narrative. But I take great pride in, probably the thing I take most pride in, is creating space for people. You know, I think that's what, I mean, Blackout has definitely done that, and Underdog has done that. But I think there are definitely times where I do look and I say, okay, maybe I should take a step back and just allow the people who I've given this space to do this, like, kind of take the baton with this and take the lead with this. I think that that's the sign of a good leader, is knowing when to step back and knowing when it's not your time to do something, or knowing when you're not supposed to be the mouthpiece or whatever. I think that we've been able to do that. I think that I've successfully been able to do that, to know when is when. Yeah, I whether it's a matter of just saying, like, okay, I'm not going to be the host of this show, you know, like, because I usually am, like, kind of like the quote unquote host of Blackout.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's like, okay, I'm not going to be the mouthpiece of this show. I'm not going to be the, you know, whatever. Like, it's not all about me, and it's never about me. And I think that's kind of where you see a lot of artists fail, is because they make it all about them. And I think that that's, of course, like, there is a certain ego in all of this that says, like, I want to be the star. I want to be, you know, the reason why people are here.
Or even, like, you know how it's supposed to work. Like, part of you hosting is probably, like, you're good at setting the table.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But you're good at it because you always do it.
Yeah, well, I've always done it, and I've created this thing. So, like, I know how it's supposed to go, or how it has worked in the past.
Right.
But, like I said, I think a sign of a good leader is knowing, okay, I don't need to lead this. I can also lead by following as well. And I've learned a lot by doing that. It took a little while for me to get comfortable with that, because, you know, Underdog and Blackout are my babies. Like, they are something that I definitely created out of a lot of love and passion, and I've put a lot of thought and energy behind. But there are times where you have to just trust that, okay, I'm not going to keep the training wheels on this situation. I'm gonna, like, let them go and just let it be what it is. And you have to trust that this bird is gonna fly. And I've seen the benefits of that. You know, our members in Blackout specifically, I think the more power and the more space that we give them to do them, and to let them just kind of be who they are, I think the better we've been as a group and as a collective. Mm. I think that we all shine brightest when we're given the space to do what we do best. Yeah, I don't feel the need to hold control all the time. That's not something that I think is conducive to what we do.
I see you living that. I mean, I think you model it well. So I hope you know you're actually achieving that thing.
I would hope so.
Because I think a lot of people want to do that, and they don't quite know how or if they are. Mm-hmm. Maybe sort of a final-ish question, because you got to go relax a little. I don't want to take up your time when you're not as crazy. Is you've done a fair amount now in dramatic and comedic spaces. Mm. And I've mostly lived my life in comedy zones. I love handling serious subjects in comedic ways. But the few times I've been on stage during what are supposed to be dramatic performances, I'm just confused. Because I like, this feels like it's not working. Yeah. And then I have to have other people say, no, that's just people paying attention. Yeah. So I'm curious if you are able to articulate some of the things that you see are shared in common in those modalities of sort of audience connection, and what you think one can do and the other can't, or if that's something you think about much. Like, this is the right thing to do in a comedy way versus this is the right thing to do in a dramatic way because of how it will connect with an audience.
Man.
And I don't know that they cleanly separate either. I'll acknowledge that. Like,
well,
a great improv show is going to be full of dramatic moments and then big bursts of those.
What's crazy is that there isn't a huge difference between the two. Because at the end of the day, what the audience wants is truth. Like, at the end of the day, if they can relate, then you've taken care of so much of the work already. Like, some of the best comedic moments and some of the best dramatic moments I've gotten to experience on stage both root from the fact that they were just so completely spot on and so completely truthful. Mm-hmm. The best comedy comes from truth. The best dramas come from truth. So I would say that as long as you attack with truth and with sincerity, you can do both very well. But you just have to be confident that your truth is sincere. I feel like a lot of, for example, improvisation groups that I see, well, a lot of their downfalls come from not being confident in that truth, from trying to either do too much or not trusting that by just being sincere and in this moment that it will work. There's tends to be lots of bells and whistles to try to cover up the fact that they're not confident in whatever that truth is. I think that if you just attack truthfully in your performance, then you'll be all right. And so when it comes to comedy, I think that, I mean, the funniest things are things that are relatable, things that are truthful. When it comes to drama, you know, the same thing, really. That's what's kind of hard to answer. That's why it's kind of hard to answer that question, because it goes so hand in hand. Blackout shows are filled with so much of both all the time, especially in our swag hat section where people put suggestions in the hat and we pick from the hat and we read it out loud and we talk on these subjects. It can get really serious really fast, and I'm always wowed by how fluidly we've ended out of drama and comedy. We do it all the time, all the time. I remember the show that we had the Friday after Jamal Clark was shot on the north side of Minneapolis, and it was the Friday right after we had a show at the Phoenix, and it was packed, and I think people were looking to see what we were going to say about it, what was going to happen. And we had a lot of really serious dialogue going on, and there would be laughs like the very next minute. And so I think that the truth will always arrest people, and it will always resonate. And if you just trust that by speaking the truth, that it'll work, then you'll be fine. Whether it's comedy, whether it's drama, you know, whether you're trying to do both at the same time, that is the bedrock of what's going to work. And I think that, you know, Blackout specifically, that has been our bedrock. And our foundation is by speaking honestly and sincerely to whatever we're talking about. And whether it's a laugh, whether it's a tear, we have earned that by being completely who we are. You know, there are people in the community that, you know, are wonderful improvisers and who we'd love to collaborate with, but they're just not very confident in their truth. And so even when it came to auditions for Blackout, you know, we saw people and we had people audition who were really great and they're really funny, but they're just not confident in who they are sincerely. Because when it comes to like the Swag Cat section, we need people to be very unafraid of who they are and the honesty that they hold.
It's a vulnerability thing.
Exactly. You have to be okay with being vulnerable and just being out there and being raw. And so, I've said the word truth like 50 times in this answer, but
I can't reject stress, that. Yeah,
you know, I can't stress enough how important that is, by just being honest. If you're honest with your audience, then the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah. Well, and truth is different than fact, which I think is significant too. Not that you're lying, but you can be vulnerable and be sharing a truth that has nothing to do with on this day.
Yeah.
So and so happened. It's an experienced truth.
It is. Whatever that truth is to you, because your truth can be completely different than mine. You know, I mean, I think we saw a lot of that in this past election. I think that we, you know,
here we go shoehorning your politics.
Yeah, you know, like there are so many people who believe what they're doing or what they're voting for is right. And at the end of the day, like, we're all trying to get to the same place. We all want happiness. We all want fairness. We all want more money in our pockets. We all want a good education for our children. We all want X, Y, and Z. It's just a matter of how we're going about it that is different.
Right.
And so when you see these different party lines, you see red states and blue states, there's just clearly a lot of people trying to get to the same place, but in different ways with the different ideals. And so whatever those ideals are, whatever those places you're coming from, whatever that is, like, as long as it is truthful, I think that you're in the right.
You just made that even more complex.
Yeah, sure.
You voted in a way that could be harmful to other people, but it's coming from a place of you believing this is the right way to get to feeling safer and more fulfilled.
Yeah, and that's what's complicated. And I think that's why it's so hard to interact with the opposing side, you know, whatever side that you're on, whatever that opposing side is. It's hard to engage. It's hard to understand one another because each side truly believes that they are right. I don't think anyone is arguing and saying, like, I know I'm wrong, but, like, no one's saying that. Everyone
is
coming,
tactic.
You know, like, but everyone believes that they are right. Everyone believes that their truth is the truth. Mm. And that's what makes it so hard to engage with, you know, the alt-right, for example.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to even refer to them as alt-right.
No, white supremacy.
You know, it's white supremacy. Like, let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
Right?
You have to say both now so people know who you're talking about, and then you can be frank about
exactly
who they actually are.
Exactly. You know, like it's hard to converse with them and to have a conversation with them because they do believe that they are in the right, that they are making complete sense. They think that, you know, Black Lives Matter is equivalent to the KKK.
Yeah.
Like, there are people who truly believe that.
Yeah.
And
who I don't think have had experience with either group based on that belief. Like, direct experience.
I have not.
To conflate the two.
I have not had a direct experience with people who have those feelings, thank goodness, because I don't know why I would even say that person, or if I could say anything to that person.
Yeah.
What, aside from, you're crazy, they're not.
Yeah.
But I've seen on TV, I've seen in social media, I've seen people who do believe these things, who believe these far-fetched ideals, and it's frustrating and it's so concerning, but at the same time, we have to find a way to engage with these people and to find some kind of common ground, because at the end of the day, we must work together to get where we want to be in this country. You know, we are not going to be able to do it alone. We've got to do it with everybody.
Yeah. It's frustrating to me how much you have to hold that empathy.
Yeah.
Because, like,
yeah.
You shouldn't have to. You should be able to be like, fuck you guys.
Yeah, man. Like, y'all are shitty. You're a shitty person. Yeah, that's
what. But you're trying to actually make change, so you're trying to be like, okay, let me see where you're at.
Yeah.
And then
you have to meet people where they're at a lot of times. Like, you can't speak to everybody the same way. You have to meet people where they're at and be there in that place with them, which is hard, but it's a real thing, and we have to be able to do it.
So reasonable.
Try to be.
It's infuriating. Well, so where can, I would like it if you could tell folks where they can find out about Blackout, where they can find out Underdog, any of the, like, is there a way to connect with all of your work, mm-hmm. or is there ways to connect with some of these things that you're a big part of driving?
Sure. So with Blackout, we have, and with Underdog, really, Facebook pages, Facebook, and social media in general.
Yeah.
Blackout Improv, check out that Facebook page, Underdog Theater, R-E,
because you're fancy.
Because we're fancy. And it's not the place, it is the art form.
Right.
Sorry, I'm going to be that person.
No, you should.
But that's what it is.
That was the most pretentious thing you've said.
That, exactly.
And that's, you didn't say it in a pretentious way. Because you deeply believe it.
I do deeply believe it. I've always believed that ER is a place, RE is the art
that's
form.
Your truth.
That is my
to
truth.
To throw what you said back in your face.
Yeah. Exactly. No, but just check out those Facebook pages, and that would probably be the best ways to keep up with us is on our social media. And Blackout and Underdog both have Twitter pages as well. Yeah, social.
And you're on Twitter.
I am also on Twitter.
Yeah.
With the handle at LaQuess, which is my middle name, LaQuess. That's where you can find most of my social media, everything on Instagram and Snapchat and all kinds of stuff. That's my handle, is at LaQuess. And that's where you can find out what's going on with me and all that. And I also have a Minnesota playlist page.
Yeah, if talent profile.
I got talent profile. Yeah. If anyone cares about that, I have that as well.
Yeah, you can find out all your work.
Yeah.
Well, Corey, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and sort of be vulnerable about all this stuff.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I appreciate being here.